Seeking mental health care can be overwhelming and even scary, but it doesn't have to be. I'm Dr. Josephine McNary, and I'm committed to making this process easier for you. Each week, my expert guest and I unravel a different form of therapeutic intervention in order to bring comfort and understanding and to help you get back to your true self. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mind Stories. Today, I'm pleased to have as our guest, Danielle Keenan Miller. She's a psychologist, scientist, teacher, and therapist. She spent more than a decade as a director of the UCLA Psychology Clinic, where she trained graduate students in evidence-based psychotherapy. She has written more than a dozen scientific articles and is the author of the Binge Eating Prevention Workbook. She has a private practice in Los Angeles, California, where she blends the art and science of psychotherapy. Today, we talk about her clinical approach to treating binge eating disorders. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Today, we're going to talk about a topic that you have expertise in, which is binge eating disorder. Maybe we can start at that pretty basic level. What is binge eating disorder?
Yeah, that's actually a good question and one a lot of people have. And the answer is a little bit more complicated than I wish it were, because there's really a spectrum from what we might consider typical eating, emotional eating, overeating, and then all the way at the end of that spectrum, binge eating disorder. Ultimately, when we're talking about binge eating disorder, we're talking about people who have frequent periods of time in their life where they're eating much more than would be considered typical given the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And that feeling of eating too much is accompanied by a number of other unwanted or unpleasant experiences. So frequently that involves a feeling of loss of control, like someone can't stop themselves from eating, eating way beyond the point of physical comfort, way beyond the point of fullness, to the point that maybe they're experiencing pain or other kinds of distress related to how much they've eaten, as well as a host of unwanted emotional experiences that might include shame or guilt for the way that they have been eating in this particular period of time. So lots of people wonder if there's a particular calorie count or something specific that defines a binge, and there really isn't. How much we would expect someone to eat in a given circumstance depends a lot on the person, their body size, their hunger. When did they last eat? For example, it would be pretty normative for anyone in our culture to eat a lot on Thanksgiving. We don't generally consider that binge eating. And we know that a significant portion of the population experiences either times where they eat more than their body really requires or so much that we would really consider it a binge.
And I wonder, what are some triggers that you see that lead up to a binge eating episode?
I always love to say that eating disorders are both about food and not about food. So the triggers can come from either category. One common and overlooked trigger for lots of folks is the experience of deprivation. So that might mean eating not enough. This is fairly common among people who put themselves on diets of some kind, particularly ones that might not actually meet their nutritional needs. And that feeling of intense hunger can build up over time and lead to a binge episode. But even perceived deprivation can have that effect. So even if someone has eaten enough calories, the sense that they haven't gotten what they really wanted can lead to a binge. So we might see someone, for example, who doesn't feel comfortable ordering what they really want in public because they're afraid of being judged. And so they order something that probably meets their nutritional needs, but doesn't satiate them on some other psychological level. That can also be a trigger for a binge. And then on the sort of the non-food side, a whole host of emotional experiences can lead to binges. There are people who binge in response to happiness, excitement, celebration, but more commonly binges occur in response to feelings of sadness, loneliness, shame, embarrassment. Ironically, a very common trigger for a binge eating episode is actually an experience of weight stigma. So when someone feels like they've been discriminated against, targeted, or made fun of because of their body shape and size, that can itself provoke future binge eating episodes.
And that leads us to this discussion about health at every size.
Yeah, it's an important discussion. And I think something that's kind of misunderstood in the popular culture. So the idea of health at every size is really reorienting our conceptions of health away from somebody's weight or body shape and towards other direct markers of their health. It's the idea that everyone should have access to good healthcare regardless of their body size. that people should eat in a way that supports their nutrition and happiness, and that they should move in ways that feel good for their body. And that we really, as clinicians, when we're treating eating disorders broadly and including binge eating disorder, we really want to help people identify what are their health goals and how do they make choices that support those health goals, rather than focusing on the number on the scale, which we know is not actually a great indicator of health once you include confounding factors.
So what are some examples of health goals or healthy targets in terms of what someone is going for?
Sure. Yeah. Sometimes it's about regulating a specific health marker like blood sugar or cholesterol that they know that they need to change to support their long-term health. For some folks, it's about increasing their sense of energy or their stamina to chase around their children, for example. So we really pull those goals into the foreground. And it's not a matter of saying that weight shouldn't change, but it's really just a reorientation away from weight and towards other markers of what it means to the individual to be healthy and happy in their life.
You hear this term diet mentality. What is that? What is that all about?
Yeah, it's such a pervasive cultural mentality that I think people often don't even realize that they have it. But the sense that the ultimate goal of health behaviors is to be in a smaller body or to have a particular shape and size sort of pervades a lot of the eating behaviors that we have in America. And that can really be a setup for binge cycles for people who are struggling with binge eating disorder. So in the course of my work with clients, when we're targeting binge eating disorder, we really try to question the assumption that being in a smaller body is better or will lead to more happiness. The truth is that I have known people both in my personal and professional life in every size body that really loved and appreciated their bodies. And I've known people across every size of body that really didn't like their bodies and struggled a great deal. So the idea that the happiness has to be linked to a particular body size is something we try to sort of question in the course of our work together.
Okay. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your workbook called the Binge Eating Prevention Workbook. Could you maybe walk us through what the strategies are in there and how does someone use it?
The book opens with a little bit of information about what binge eating disorder is and then walks folks through an assessment of their own risk factors for binge eating. So people can end up binge eating for lots of different reasons, and the most effective interventions are going to map on an individual level to the reasons that people are stuck in a binge eating cycle. So we help people try to identify specifically for themselves what is triggering or maintaining binge eating. And then we present a variety of different sorts of strategies to help address those specific factors. So for everybody, we encourage them to read the chapters on letting go of the diet mentality and adopting a different way of approaching health, as well as the chapters on goal setting, which we think are an important foundation for this sort of work for everyone. But then readers are guided towards specific chapters that might focus more on behavioral types of changes they can make, changes to the way that they think, changes to how they're managing or responding to emotion, as well as changes that they might make in their environment that will help them be less likely to get stuck in a binge cycle.
Okay. And is this workbook meant to be used in conjunction with work with a therapist and a psychologist or a registered dietitian?
It can be used that way. And I have lots of colleagues who say that they are using the book with their clients. But I'll say one of the nice things about binge eating disorder and part of what motivated me to write the book is that there's actually very good evidence that self-help is quite an effective strategy for binge eating if people can get access to good evidence-based tools. So it can be used as a standalone. Sometimes folks see me as they're working their way through the book. Maybe they need periodic coaching, but there are also people who feel more empowered when they're using it alongside weekly individual therapy.
And I was wondering if we could talk about some of the cognitive traps that lead people to engage in binge eating behaviors.
Yeah. There are a couple of big ones. One of the most common ones, and one of the ones that I try to target early in treatment, is the idea that there are good or bad foods. Once you've started to divide the world into foods that you're allowed or not allowed, or foods that feel morally right or wrong, that sets up that mindset of deprivation that I talked about earlier. And it can also lead people to have the experience of sort of giving up on following their eating goals once they've had a deviation from their plan. So lots of times I hear, for example, once I had eaten two cookies, I felt so bad about the two cookies that I had that I figured I may as well eat the whole box of cookies. So we're really trying to break that idea that only some foods are acceptable to eat, and instead promote the idea that sort of all foods fit into a healthy and supportive diet, that we're choosing our foods based not only on their nutritional value, but also on our preferences, on culture, on the setting and the time and what's available, and that we can have that kind of flexibility in our diet while still focusing on our health. Another really important thinking trap that I hear people get into is the idea that they can't control themselves around certain kinds of food. And it may be, and it often is, in fact, the case for folks that they have had experiences where eating a particular food or a particular type of food has preceded a binge eating episode. But that mentality can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And unless someone can really put themselves in an environment where they're never, ever going to be around that type of food again, it's not a very effective way to think. So one of the things that we introduce in treatment is having people in the safe and contained environment of a therapy session have small amounts of foods that they fear they can't have in controlled amounts, and have them have the lived experience of, I can have a bit of this or a few bites of this or a serving of this, and not have it lead to a whole binge.
Okay, and I'm also wondering, how common is binge eating disorder?
It's actually quite common. It's more common than anorexia and bulimia combined, even though those tend to be far more well-known eating disorders. And the prevalence estimates vary a little bit depending on the definition you use, but somewhere between 3 and 8%, sometimes a little lower, sometimes a little higher. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that it's one of the few eating disorders that's equally prevalent in men and women. So there isn't the gender split that we often see between men and women in eating disorders. There's more research that needs to be done, but there's some early indication that binge eating disorder may be somewhat more common among people that have a non-male or female gender identity. So people who are trans or people who identify as non-binary might have somewhat elevated rates of binge eating disorder.
Why do you think that's the case?
There is still more research to be done for sure, but we know that any time that people have dysphoria about their appearance in some way, or that their appearance feels not right to them, that can leave folks at an increased risk of eating disorders, broadly speaking.
Okay. I was wondering also, because you hear the word binge eating disorder a lot, it's kind of out there on social media. What are the myths that people bring into your clinical work with you, and maybe the work you do to educate them on this?
Yeah. I would say the most common one is that binge eating disorder is a failure of willpower. Most people, I think, have the conception that binge eating disorder is just someone not trying hard enough to set limits about their eating. Most of the people that I see clinically have tried very, very, very hard to stop themselves from binge eating, but haven't been successful, largely because this isn't a willpower issue. The other major myth that people often share with me when they're starting treatment is the idea that they can't get better, because the binge eating episodes themselves feel so out of control that sometimes people worry that something sort of takes over them and they're not going to be able to intervene. The reality of it is that evidence-based approaches for binge eating disorder are really quite successful. So approaches rooted in CBT and the family of treatments related to CBT, as well as treatments related to interpersonal therapy and DBT, are all really quite effective for treating binge eating disorder. So there's no reason for folks who have this concern to just live with it, struggle with it, tolerate it on their own. There really are effective options out there for intervening.
Is there some genetic or inherited component of binge eating disorder?
Yeah, there is a genetic component. It's not a very large genetic liability, but there certainly is a genetic component related both specifically to family members having binge eating, but also having other eating disorder presentations in one's family.
At what age can you start to see binge eating disorder, and how young can you see it?
Binge eating disorder can start quite early. This is an area in which there is also a need for more research in terms of how we approach treatment specifically with children, but lots of clients identify that they began binge eating as a child, often related to intense parental restrictions around what they ate and the need to hide food or eat in secret. It can also be a factor for children who are experiencing food insecurity. We know that food insecurity is a very strong predictor of the onset of binge eating disorder. And so kids who are coming from environments where they're not always sure when or where the next meal is coming from are particularly at risk for an early presentation of binge eating.
Well, you educated me quite a bit about binge eating disorder today. This is really helpful. I'm going to check out the book and I'll make sure your information is in the episode description. So if the listener wants to learn more about you and the work and specifically about your book, they can easily access information about that. Before we say goodbye, any last words you want to leave the listener with? Maybe a listener who might be struggling with binge eating disorder, or maybe someone who is listening because they have someone they love who is struggling?
Yes, I would say there are effective treatments out there. There's no reason to struggle alone in silence, and that there is a way to shift one's relationship with food so that there's a greater sense of peace and happiness on the day-to-day in one's life.
Well, thanks for being on and sharing all of this with us. I love the last statement because it's something that with the right treatment, it's very treatable. And so I think that's the important thing to highlight. Thanks for being on. Take care. This has been Mind Stories with me, Josephine McNary of Cal Psychiatry. With online psychiatry in California and 13 offices throughout Southern California and the Bay Area, Cal Psychiatry specializes in medication management, ADHD, anxiety disorders, alternative therapies, women's mental health, and more. Visit us at calpsychiatry.com and let us help you get back to your true self. Thanks for listening to Mind Stories, and don't forget to subscribe.